Call to order the February 3rd, 2009 session of the House Subcommittee on Workforce Development. Good morning, everyone. We're going to be having another in our series of informational meetings this morning. We've had representatives from various state agencies in to talk to us about workforce development. We've also most recently had the business perspective. And this morning we're going to be focusing on the labor perspective, and the bulk of that is going to be from the apprenticeship, the apprenticeship trades. So with that, I'd like to thank all of you who've come out this morning, and I'd like to call up first Ron Murray from Local 290, the Plumbers and Fitters. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Ron Murray, and I represent the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters. And, Mr. Chair, would you just like me to begin? Or
please, please do.
Thank you. I believe that my testimony today is basically going to be in two parts, and I hope that you will feel like you can interrupt me and ask questions, because I'm not quite sure where I'm headed today. But my testimony is going to be, the first part is going to be relative to apprenticeship programs, and the second part is going to be specific to my work on three separate workforce investment boards in the state of Oregon. I have over 20 years a combined experience with the Workforce Investment Act in 1997. So I'm sure the chair would admit that I'm probably one of the most outspoken labor people on some of the problems we're having in the workforce program. But that being said, I did enter an apprenticeship program approximately 32 years ago. I have 2 degrees from Lewis and Clark College, Business Administrative Studies, and a master's in public administration, and decided to become a licensed journeyman plumber. I believe our apprenticeship program, is very typical of union apprenticeship programs. And it's also solidified a little bit by the fact that we have very strong plumber licensing in Oregon, and much of the work I do here in the Capitol is to ensure public safety through licensing of plumbers and steam fitters, and we have been very successful with that. The United Association's Plumber and Steam Fitter Apprenticeship Program is completely private funded in the on the union side. Somebody paid for my education to go through a 5-year apprenticeship program, and now I'm paying back to young folks, and we have a great number of women that are now in our apprenticeship program, so we're paying for their education just as somebody paid for mine. There's absolutely no cost to the apprentice in any way, shape, or form to go through our apprenticeship program. It's completely free to them. They do have to buy their books. And they go to school 2 nights a week for a period of 5 years, and that's combined with 8 hours of work a day. So it's a pretty busy schedule, and we take lots of folks that are, I guess you'd say, middle-aged or experienced in the workforce, and so they may have children at home and so forth. So it's a tremendous commitment that they make. The United Association has 11 training centers throughout the state of Oregon, from corner to corner. Our largest is in Tualatin. It's approximately 75,000 square feet. We have a brand-new investment in White City, which is Medford. Beautiful building, brand new building in the Eugene Springfield area, and some of the other areas are a little bit smaller. But we've made an investment in our community. Typically, we build our own buildings, we own our own buildings, and here again, we take no public money. No funding in any way, shape, or form. We currently have approximately four.
Ron, would you excuse us just a minute? Vice Chair Huffman, I think, would like to ask you a question.
Oh, yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could just kind of be maybe a little more informal here, Ron, and ask questions. You have 11 training centers. Some are larger than others. Is the curriculum basically the same, or is there travel to a larger area at certain times for training aspects that you can't get at one of the smaller venues?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman. The curriculum, apprenticeship curriculum, would be identical at all 11 training centers. So in that aspect, we would have economy of scale. Keeping in mind, the apprenticeship year would be broken into two terms. So you know what is going to be taught, or it's consistent from term to term to term. And, of course, each training center might be on a different term depending upon the ages of their apprentices. Kind of a follow-up to a part of a question you didn't ask, but you kind of did, is that we also offer tremendous journeyman training. And the reason for that is, for example, if you're in the state of Oregon, you have to be a licensed journeyman plumber to install medical gas systems. So any work in a hospital, which is the anesthesia gases, the vacuum, oxygen lines, medical air, which drives the tools in the operating rooms, it has to be done by a licensed journeyman plumber. That's beyond the scope of an apprentice to do. So what we do then is we offer journeyman classes. So because they're more narrow in scope and shorter, we will have an instructor travel to the different training centers to provide that. And, for example, my expertise is residential fire sprinklers, which is a really up-and-coming thing, and a new project, which is self-contained breathing apparatus for firefighters. We install pipes in the buildings. That's a brand-new technology. And so we would travel throughout the state to provide that training. With that, we have a very high turnout rate of our apprentices, and I think that makes us unique, and I think it makes all of the union programs very unique, and that is we just don't take people in because they're a profit center. And we see other programs that actually will do that. You know, in an economic time like this, we have to weigh how many people we will bring into the apprenticeship program. And the reason for that is it doesn't make sense for us to start 100 new plumber apprentices today if we don't have work for them. We're not making money off them tuition-wise, and it doesn't make sense for them to go to school if they don't have a job during the day. So we're not looking at our apprentices as a profit center. So we're trying to weigh these tough economic times with the fact that we still have to be able to turn out a journeyman plumber in 5 years. Where will the market be then? As I said, since we don't look at this as a money-making operation, we have a little more flexibility in how we bring in apprentices and where they will be in their career. So, are there any questions on apprenticeship?
Yes, Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you address the, and you kind of hinted at it there, but if you could expand just a little bit on the training pipeline, the demand versus the need, and just kind of where the industry is, because your industry is probably, depending on the workforce region, but probably in the top 10 of probably all of the 15 workforce regions as far as demand for the future as projected by the study. So how do you feel you're equipped with these 11 training centers? Is the pipeline big enough to meet the projected future demand or hopeful demand?
Chair Witt, Representative Huffman, I believe what the study actually shows as well is that the occupation that is fourth in demand is welders, and I believe plumbers are seventh or eighth on the list. So I think that that's a very positive projection for us. Excuse me. We don't. I think that we typically in years past, we would see 1,000 applicants for every position. We don't see that now. And I think that that is I think it's directly related simply to our social condition, and some folks simply don't want to work in the trades because it can be very physical and very demanding. Yet, we certainly don't have a shortage of applicants. One of the things that the United Association has done is we actually have hired professionals to work with the minority community to bring people into the trades. We have a very high ratio of women and minorities in our apprenticeship programs and are very proud of the work that we have done to recruit people for our apprenticeship program. There's certainly not a shortage of individuals or applicants, I should say, for the apprenticeship program at this time. The absolute positive number one concern that we have, though, is our applicants are not qualified. And by that we mean they do not have adequate math skills, and they're marginal sometimes on their reading as well. But math is our number one problem. I actually wrote a grant to bring an instructor in, and we did what we call math in the trades. And it was somewhat of a remedial program. And these were all middle-aged people, I'll tell you. The youngest folks were probably in their 30s. In one way, we brought 10 folks in. In one way, it was a disaster for us because these folks were so motivated to go to work, and the employer saw them as so motivated that they all had jobs before we could hire them. So out of the 10, one fell off the face of the earth. We never found out where he went. And the other folks all found jobs because employers could see, look how motivated these folks are. And the plumbers union was able to teach them basic math. We have asked the workforce program, why don't you have classes aimed at preparing people for our apprenticeship programs? And I'm not talking about internships. We don't like internships. But just the basic remedial math. And they said, no one would take the classes. So the pipeline that we're looking for, we have attempted. Let me take you back one step. I'll tell you a quick story before I go to my workforce stuff. At our office in Tualatin, we sent a letter to the three major school districts that surround our training center, and that would incorporate Tualatin, Tigard, Wilsonville, Sherwood, and West Lynn. And we sent a letter to all of the school districts, the superintendents of the districts, and what we offered them was this. You can use our facility during the day at no charge. No charge whatsoever. You can use our weld shop during the day at no charge, and we will provide all of the consumables for you. There will be no charge in any way, shape, or form for you to use our facilities. We did not receive one response. We didn't even receive a response that said no, thank you. So I told my boss, I said, let's expand this. So we sent the same letter to every single board member in those three school districts. We did not receive one response, not one. We said, you send your kids here, we'll teach them at no charge to you. And we couldn't get a response. So when you talk about the pipeline, I think the pipeline's broken, but it's broken well before it gets to us. With my background, one of the concepts that we are kicking around is we begin to recruit for journeyman or for apprentice plumbers and steam fitters at colleges. Because we have found that graduates of four-year college institutions do very well in the trades. So with that,
if you'd hold on just for a moment here, I think Representative Dembro had a question as well. I appreciate this, Ron, if we're interrupting your train of thought, I apologize.
That's fine, sir. I just thought though, and someone has a question.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Ron, I want to drill down a little into the pipeline, if you excuse the metaphor. But before I do that, I just want to say that I really appreciate your last comment about perhaps looking at the colleges for a source of workers. of apprenticeships. I myself am from the community college world, and I really feel that that's a logical pool for you to draw from, and students who have already gone through the math programs and you know, have done those, have kind of gotten their heads back into school, and they're ready to go. But anyway, going back to the pipeline, could you be a little more specific about what kind of numbers we're talking about? You know, you said that you're having great success at recruiting women and minorities into the pipeline. So what kind of numbers are we talking about? And
Chair Wood, Representative Dembrough, at this time, specifically, we have approximately 150 to 175 apprentices in the plumbing program, and there are 7 women in the plumbing program. The rest of our, and just so you know, the economy of scale, we have 3 times as many steam fitters as we do plumbers, so that will kind of give you an idea where we're at. So the other 200 or 225 apprentices would be steam fitter apprentices, and I believe we have 17 women and minorities in that program. From a realistic point of view, it is more difficult to recruit women for the plumbing program simply because of the scope of work, if you allow your imagination to wander. So it's very, very physical. With steam fitters, there are more opportunities for, I'd say, lighter work, for example, HVAC or refrigeration or perhaps control tubing or something like that. Many times the plumbing can be very, very physical, so we do see fewer women. We've also worked with programs in the Portland area, 2 separate programs. One, an attempt to bring in youth that were challenged, that have had a lot of problem. And the program now, for lack of a better term, is that the opposite extreme. You try to bring in the best and the brightest and recruit from inner city churches. Quite frankly, our success ratio was equal with either group. So,
Ron, I want to bore down a little bit here on one of the statements that you made, and you described how you had sent letters out to 3 surrounding school districts as well as the board members and didn't receive a single response. This committee has had a number of discussions already about our desire to make recommendations of how our schools can better prepare students for the workforce, and Representatives Esquivel and Dembrough have taken upon their own to assist the committee in setting up. We're gonna be working through this and actually making some recommendations as a committee. This is very much to that issue. And I understand that you probably don't have any direct knowledge of why you didn't get a response. If you don't get a response, you don't get to obviously probe. But do you at least have a gut feeling? I mean, this is fundamentally a problem with our school system preparing our future workforce. And do you have any sense of why this took place? I'm flabbergasted, frankly.
Chair Witt, yes, and I will try to be polite. And the bottom line is, I just don't think that they think that we're good enough for them. If I may beg your indulgence, I think I have gray hair, and none of you do. So, and I've been at this a long time.
Long ways from you.
I'm a graduate of Roosevelt High School. And if you're not familiar with Roosevelt, Roosevelt is one of the 10 worst high schools in the state of Oregon. And yet my heart, and my wife's heart as a graduate, is still with Roosevelt High School. So we said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to go to the principal of Roosevelt High School, and we will tell them that we will actually appoint business agents to be personally responsible for one kid. If we need to kick them in the butt and get them out of school, we'll be at the front door. We'll get them to school. We'll get them through school. And if they're interested in becoming a plumber and a fitter, great. If not, if we've had a little bit of success in their life, then that's good too. I can't get them to return my phone calls. They're just too busy for us. And if you go to a high school and you ask, if you ask the counselor, the Portland Public Schools said the counselors are just too busy to deal with you. And if you go to a school and you ask, where are the kids that aren't being successful? They're downstairs. They're in the shop. We just put them down there so they can play with the tools so they don't hurt the other kids. I think when you look back on your high school career, you're going to say, the kids that took the shop classes were the kids that might not be successful in math. In my career, I didn't take any shop classes. I was very fortunate. And the one thing, too, we don't want to go to a school and hold up our paycheck and say, I'm the plumber and I wear a Rolex and that's my Corvette out front. We don't want you here because we pay good money, and you know what the prevailing wage rate is for plumbers or electricians, so I don't need to tell you. It's just I believe in the public school system, we just get no respect. If I think that's the simplest way to put it.
Ron, I want to, again, I'm continuing to bore down on this. Thank you. If there is a sense that you're just not good enough, would you please explain to our committee here your math requirements, why it takes 5 years to go through your apprenticeship program, and additionally, where your local's apprenticeship program ranks in terms of national and international recognition?
Yes, Chair Witt, if I can remember all that. Our apprenticeship program is world-renowned. We have shared our instructors with Europe, which is, when we look at back where apprenticeship started, it was hundreds of years ago in the European countries and so forth and so on. And so we've actually shared our instructors with Germany. In our apprenticeship program, I personally am the vice president of the American Society of Sanitary Engineering. We're very heavily invested in codes because we know states that have strong codes have stronger public safety laws. In an apprenticeship program, the code section itself for a plumber is easily a year. It's because, and I think that here again, I think the requirements on the statewide level have decreased because we used to have to memorize pages and pages and pages of charts to do with water flow and pressures and the capacity of the plumbing systems and so forth and so on. And now simply having a code as a reference is sufficient. As far as the math requirement, we require basically 2 years of high school math. So nothing too stringent. If you can get through high school algebra, that's certainly more than sufficient for us. And simply put, much of our work is angles, and you don't think about plumbing as that way, but we still know that it still flows downhill. So if you start here, how deep does it have to be when it hits the street, or how high do you have to be in the building, and so forth and so on. So we do percentages, you just become accustomed to using the math and decimal equivalents of scale and converting inches to decimal equivalents and percentages and so forth and so on. So we do require that, and we are very heavily invested in geometry. We think that's pretty simple requirements that we ask.
And nonetheless, your program requires 5 years. Is there what role does considerations for bloodborne pathogens and that sort of thing play in this?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. He's been reading my book. In all reality, the first 6 months of an apprenticeship, we just hope they don't get hurt. And so you're kind of teaching them the basics of don't get hurt, and what to watch for in a job site, and so they can kind of get their head around their new atmosphere and so forth and so on. But I think our trade has evolved, and we have developed a program, and we were fortunate enough to receive a grant from OSHA. It's called Pathogens for Plumbers, and the reason for that is we have discovered that, particularly in our trade, that the plumber is incredibly susceptible to bloodborne pathogens and pathological diseases on the work site. We currently have almost double the national average of hepatitis C. We have many members that have contracted MRSA from working on hospital sites. The World Plumbing Council has appointed me to develop a program called Pathogens for Plumbers, which we've expanded to Pathogens for Pipelines. And the People's Republic of China has actually invited me to speak to their engineers, and I spoke at the World Plumbing Council in Beijing, China. And this is all a program that came out of Local 290 in concern for our workers.
Thank you very much. Representative Polby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron, I appreciate all your comments. I want to go back, though, to the very beginning when I just have a couple of comments when you were talking about journeyman plumbers and the need for apprentices. I'm curious, as a licensed trade, do you have to complete an apprenticeship to become licensed?
Chair Witt, Representative Holby, yes, you do. In the state of Oregon, you must either complete an apprenticeship or have approved experience. Since not every state has licensing, do not accept plumbers from jurisdictions that would not have comparable training or experience requirements for a journeyman plumber license. It's possible, but if it is not legally recognized training, then they would have to complete an apprenticeship.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And also, you know, you were talking, Representative Huffman had asked a question about, you know, the type of training at these different places or different training centers you have throughout the state. And I wanted to, just because of my knowledge of it, I guess, just reiterate that there are standards that have to be met through the apprenticeship program, no matter what training facility you're at, that are consistent around the state to become a journeyman plumber. That's accurate, I assume.
Yes, sir.
And in the training, do your standards have a requirement in there somewhere that for as far as a utilization rate for how many apprentices or have to work for a particular contractor, a particular job, or is there a percentage that the plumbers use?
Chair Witt, Representative Holvey, absolutely. It's really not an apprenticeship program if you don't have direct supervision from your journeyman. And so the apprenticeship committee in each area within the state has their own apprenticeship committees, are able to decide what the apprenticeship ratio is. That's another reason why if the economy turns down and we don't have journeyman plumbers working, we can't hire new apprentices because there wouldn't be journeyman plumbers to put them with. So it's kind of the trickle-down effect, and we aren't able to take in as many apprentices. The other thing we have to be very careful of, and I would ask that you watch other apprenticeship programs, how they do this, is, you know, if you aren't a completely ethical contractor, you're going to want to take 100 first-term apprentices because they don't make very much money. And as the apprentice, the way our apprenticeship program works is basically they get a 5% raise every 6 months. Well, if you call for an apprentice, you don't want a fifth-year apprentice because they're making almost as much as a journeyman. So we will see some apprenticeship programs that basically wash out apprentices when they advance in their career because they're simply too expensive. So they front-load their apprenticeship program with apprentices that are 6-month, 1-year, 2-year apprentices, because basically you're getting free labor. That's not ethical. That's not right. That's not what an apprenticeship program is about. These folks aren't free labor. They're learning a trade, and we respect that. So,
thank you very much. Vice Chair Huffman?
Thank you, Chair. Just a comment. Did you speak before this committee last year? Because the reason I ask, I remember the story about you reaching out to the local high schools and getting no response. I was just going to comment. You just might keep knocking on doors, because I went back to the Dalles and talked to our high school principal about your dilemma there, and he said, oh my gosh, if somebody made that offer to me, I'd be all over it. So it's all in the individual, the perspective, whatever.
I'm sure. Should I go into my
Please.
Second part? Thank you, Mr. Chair. This one will be a little quicker. As I said, I sit, as of January 1st, I sat on three separate workforce boards, from a small one down on the coast to the largest, which is, we would call it the City of Portland's Workforce Board, but it's Multnomah, Washington County. I have many years of experience working for the in the workforce system, and what I tell each workforce board is when I begin every speech, I think I start with, what is the first word in workforce investment? It's workforce, and I represent the workforce, and I can guarantee you the workforce is not represented in the workforce investment system. They are the dirty sheep. Their voice is not heard. They are not respected for the most part in the workforce system, and they literally have no voice. I could give testimony here for hours on end of how the workforce system in the state of Oregon is broken. I can tell you that the economic development from the state of Oregon spent over $130,000 in the Portland area to send family wage jobs out of state. And the only way that I was able to catch that is they came back for more money. And they actually went to a union that was out of state, it was in the Seattle area, to come down and replace Oregon workers for half the scale that they were making. This is the kind of investments that we make with the workforce program. In many areas, the Workforce Investment Board is simply a cash cow. I could tell you about a program on the coast where money was allotted for journeyman plumbers to travel to Alabama to receive air conditioning training. And fortunately, we were able to stop that, and we asked them, why would you do that? If you can get this training for free at any union facility. And if you don't want to use a union training facility, the community college will still provide it. And they said, well, this is how we want to spend our money. I can tell you about the refrigeration technicians that would be members of our union that were replaced by workers making minimum wage, because the workforce system felt like this was a tremendous investment, because the minimum wage workers were going to get a 50-cent an hour wage if they worked on anhydrous ammonia system. We don't think that's a good trade-off. I can tell you, I currently sit on a board that recommended funding for one individual at a cost of $34,000 to take a class. How does the public benefit from that? We recently approved on one of our boards funding for three identical classes for three separate businesses using the same curriculum. And my question was, well, couldn't we just combine them? No, wouldn't be convenient. There is no oversight of the outcome of the workforce system. There is no oversight of how the money is allotted. There is money left on the table for some programs, and other programs go unfunded. And the reason that I don't sit on three workforce boards as I sit before you today is it's born of frustration, because literally labor has no voice in the workforce system. And unfortunately, Representative Witt probably bears most of my ire, and he listens very politely, because he's the only one I have to yell at. To give you a specific example, where you may have heard my comments last session, is I'm the one that submitted an amendment to the governor's bill to defund one of my workforce boards because they simply won't listen to the worker. And I'm also the one that stood up at a meeting in Manhattan, New York, and said, I think you should strip all funding from the Workforce Investment Act of 1997 because the worker isn't benefiting from it. And we're very frustrated. I'm not sitting here as a labor representative asking for the money, because as you can see, we're pretty successful without it. But I think it could certainly be spent better than it is now.
Ron, that's a very serious indictment of the workforce board as it currently exists or operates. Do you have any recommendations that would make, I think, what you would call a bad situation better?
Chair Witt, I think I do. I would like to see an investment made in the trades and in union apprenticeship programs. And the reason that I do pick union apprenticeship programs is we have proven that we are successful, without a question or a doubt. When you look at the number of apprentices that we successfully turn out, our percentage of successful applicants, you can see we're successful. What we're seeing is, let me rephrase that. I would like to see labor have a greater stake in the workforce system. I would like to see the trades have more input in the workforce system. Everyone from the President of the United States to the Governor of the State of Oregon to our State Treasurer has said that we need to make a stronger investment in apprenticeship programs, and we're not doing it. As your committee has pointed out today, two of the top 10 occupations that we are predicting there will be a shortage of are welders and plumbers. And yet, literally, the state makes no investment in the training of these individuals. And I do think that there needs to be some guidance and redirection.
Ron, you had several examples of judgment calls that, from your perspective, just don't ring true. I find what you've just told this committee very troubling. My question is, you couldn't have been the only board member that viewed those as inappropriate judgment calls on how to conduct the training or to spend the money. You've come to this from a labor perspective, but I mean I don't care what your background is. At some point, there's right and there's wrong, and it stretches credibility and imagination to think that we would be spending some of the money in the ways that you have just described for our committee. Were there others that shared your concerns?
Chair Witt, first of all, it's a very, very, very big system. And in the state of Oregon, I believe last year the Workforce Investment Act funded the state of Oregon to the tune of $57 million. Typically, the boards, and I sit on a full board, and the board will meet every 2 months or perhaps every 3 months. The board will not be privy as a whole the Workforce Investment Board. And to give you an example, the Clackamas Board probably has 25 members on it. Half of them, and many of these members are in the workforce system are required. And so you'll have many government entities that sit on the workforce boards representing government. And it's difficult to get private sector members on the board because it's a time-consuming thing. The boards as a whole are not aware of how the money is spent. We do not, as a board members, get a breakdown into what projects are funded. And the only way that that can happen is for someone like myself who has enough experience on the boards to ask that you be appointed to a committee which might be called the Workforce Response Team. The Portland Board, I believe, is called something else. And you have to literally be there when either an application is approved or you simply have to hear about it. It's not a transparent transaction, I guess you would say. The incidents that I've described to you were brought to me either by concerned individuals or someone may say, hey, I heard about this. Would you look into it? The funding of the one individual for $35,000, I know about that because I sit on that workforce response team and I sat on that committee. And so not only did I oppose it, but at that time the executive director did too and said, this is not a viable use of WIA dollars. And so that one was turned down. The others, like I said, were approved. It's simply there aren't... To further answer your question, on my Clackamas board, there are three labor representatives. There happen to be three labor representatives on the Portland board. There were only two representatives on the Clatsop County board. And labor, and just so you know, labor is not as involved, for example, with the Clatsop Tillamook Columbia County Board, because that jurisdiction, economically, they have their own issues. And when we look at the economy in that area, I think labor is very, very sensitive. We just need to get the economy going. That's the most important part there. So.
And Ron, I very much appreciate the information that you brought forward, and I appreciate that you serve on those boards as a representative of organized labor and the good job that your apprenticeship council does. But these should not be labor issues. These are judgment issues. And you sit on that board, and other members sit on that board in the public's interest to oversee workforce development and training. And again, I don't see this as a labor issue. Were there others that saw this as a problem as you have seen it and brought to this committee here today?
Representative Witt, the answer would be no. And the reason is I think people just don't know. To give you the specific example of where the money was funded to send jobs out of state, and that did come from the Region 2 Workforce Board. I believe what happened is economic development went and it's not to the board, because these decisions aren't board-level decisions. These would be like managerial-level decisions. And they made a good case. They didn't say, we're replacing Oregon workers with out-of-state workers. It took basically someone calling me after the money had already been funded, and it was in the pipeline, and the actions had already taken place. And someone called me and said, how could this happen? And of course, the answer is, well, we didn't know. And as I began to look into it, the truth did come to light that, of course, the folks that made the decision weren't aware. And I believe they made an innocent mistake. I really, truly do. I think that that's a phenomenal board, and it has really good leadership. But it just basically stunk from the inception of this proposal.
Ron, some of this is potentially serious. It's all extremely shocking, and I know that you have given me an indication of the past that there were problems, but I'm telling you, it's moved from problem level to, as I say, I'm shocked here. It's easy to ask that someone else create work, or that we create work for you, but I think we've reached the point here where this committee would be well served if you could develop a list of judgment calls that have been made in terms of funding that you think were inappropriate, and approximately when those were made and by which one of the boards that you sat on, because quite frankly, I'm at a point right now where I think that this committee owes an obligation to the public trust that some of these be followed up. Is that a list that you can do?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is.
Do you have time to do that, and do I need to ask your boss to allow you time to do that?
No, sir, I can do that.
All right. I would be greatly appreciative. As I say, at some point, you've invoked our responsibility here to the public as a committee to follow up on this, and I think we've reached that point, sir.
Very well.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, I'm unhooked just enough here that I don't remember who was next, Representative Dembro.
Well, actually, I've already let Representative
Escobar
go. And then,
you have to go to the right.
But reserve my place.
Thank you.
I'm personally appalled at what I'm being told here. Not only appalled, but very concerned. We're stewards of the people's money. And I would personally like to follow up on this and find out what's what, separate wheat from chaff here, because if someone's making these decisions, to me it's almost like I'm making a decision, but I'm giving you just enough information so you'll say okay, but I'm not feeding you the adequate information to let you see the whole picture. And to me, that's no different than blatantly misleading you, because if you don't tell all the truth, then to me it's almost like a lie. So I have a real very, very concern, just like Chairman Witt has here, but I would like to see us follow up on this and go forward with this, because this is not acceptable if that's the case. But I think we need to find out.
Thank you, Representative Esquivel. I'm a little comfort in numbers here. At least, when my meter reaches that point where we have a problem, I'm glad to see that I'm not there alone. Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a little bit on another topic, but it's also related to the workforce boards. In my experience, the workforce boards tend to gravitate more towards what I might call short-term training programs as opposed to long-term trade apprenticeship programs. And the rationale for it that I've been given is that the short-term programs are more nimble and able to meet the needs of changing business and industry, whereas the trade programs are slower to adapt and to meet the immediate needs of business. And this is often brought up when discussions are around green kinds of business and sustainability, et cetera. And I wonder if you would address that. And this is also actually a question that I would probably throw out to all the speakers as they come forward. You know, to what extent, what is the downside to the short-term training program? I mean, my own concern is that we might be training people for a job that's here today, and then that job goes away, and they have to then be retrained again and again and again. And I wonder if you would address that.
Chair Witt, Representative Dembrough, when I sit on a board, I do believe that I don't simply represent labor, but also the public good. And so, for example, if they have a program, let's say someone is not familiar with the workforce or has not been successful in the workforce, and there's a training program that might get them started on a full-time job at, let's say, McDonald's. I think that's a very positive step because it is getting them into the workforce. They may simply not have never had good people skills or simply know you have to be at work on time or so forth and so on. So some of the short programs, I believe, are successful because they are targeting a very, very specific need, and workers that need to be, or workers that might have deficiencies in simply being able to get a job and to hold a job. And I think that the workforce program does serve that interest. When we talk about short-term programs, though, it has also been explained to me that when a program is funded, it is funded basically for, as it was explained, one butt in one chair for one day. That, by definition, is a full-time student. And the training organization will receive a full term worth of compensation from the workforce system if the student is in the class one day. What we don't look at is, can an individual in an ESL program learn to speak English in 9 weeks if they only sat in class one day? And my answer would be no. But the way the system is established, the training facility would still receive full reimbursement. What happens in the workforce program, if I may, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, is many times a training provider will, on their own or through economic development, contact a large manufacturer, let's say, and say, wouldn't you like your folks to go through this training program? And it will be at no cost to you, and you'll get reimbursed for the worker's time and so forth and so on. And, of course, the manufacturer is going to say, well, yeah, that sounds great. And that's how many of the training partners get their revenue, is they actually shop it. And I'll give you a specific example, which would probably be on my list. On the Clackamas board, we received a proposal for management training for individuals that they made $22 an hour, but they needed more training because there was a very high turnover rate and they happened to go to work at midnight. And I asked, and so the board was willing to grant this training opportunity for these folks because there was very high turnover rate for these folks that went to work at midnight. And I think this is where a guy that works for a living kind of separates himself from some of the other folks on the board. And I said, what do you call somebody that goes to work at midnight? That's the graveyard shift. The individual makes $22 an hour, makes a good living. There is nothing that you can do to change the turnover rate for someone that goes to work at midnight other than having start work at 8 o'clock in the morning. It isn't a training issue. It's the fact that they went to work at midnight. And until you kind of bring the committee back to see, most folks aren't comfortable to go to work at midnight. You do it because you have to have a job or whatever, and the first thing you do when you work the graveyard shift, I know because I've been there, is you try to get to the day shift. So, of course, there's a high turnover rate. And we would consider $22 an hour in Clackamas a family wage. So it was a way for somebody to make money off the workforce system, but it wasn't solving the problem. Does that answer your question?
Additional questions or comments? Ron, again, you brought things to this committee's attention here that is part of the public record, I think, demands that we take a look at some of those specifics. Do you have, again, it's very easy for someone to put demands on somebody else's time schedule, but a rough approximation of how long it might take you to put together a list, a week's time, something like that?
Perhaps a week.
Okay.
Sure, that would be my pleasure.
I and I think the committee would appreciate that list. Representative Dembro first and then Holby.
I have nothing.
Representative Holby?
Just a comment that Ron made earlier that labor doesn't seem to have a voice in these workforce investment boards. And I've never served on a workforce investment board, but have tried to work with one from time to time and became frustrated at that same scenario where it was seemed like it was the Chamber of Commerce and one or two people from labor. And but it's my understanding that is basically a requirement of how many people serve on these boards that is instituted in the Workforce Investment Act at the federal level, that they call out how many members from labor, how many members from business, how many members from government. And so it's not something that the state necessarily has control over, other than the governor asking for a waiver to add members, but I'm not sure that they would be voting members. Can you comment on that?
Chairman Witt, Representative Holvey, yes. Actually, I believe the statute requires that there be labor representatives. It does not define a specific number of labor representatives. Some boards interpret that as having one labor person. I don't believe it's been tested in court. It may have. But the other opinion is that representatives are plural, and so each board shall have a minimum of two. The statute does not set the minimum number of labor representatives as a whole. It simply requires certain mandated partners, for example, the employment department and economic development, so forth. But there is not a maximum number of labor representatives. And perhaps in closing, I should simply say, and I know the AFL-CIO has worked on this, and as have other unions, it is, and the reason I sit on so many boards is it is such an incredibly sharp learning curve. The nuances of the workforce system and all of the different things that get involved, it's literally a full-time job. So it's for a new member on the board, you really are a babe in the woods for a couple of years. And that's simply how I've gotten to be in the unfortunate place I am.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Representative. I'm just curious if our committee administrator could follow up on that, because when we had testimony here by members representing the Workforce Investment Board, they had certain criteria of how many members from the private sector, from business, from government, from labor, and as I recall that testimony, it was, you know, labor had three positions, and I think private business had 20 or something like that. Don't quote me on that, but anyway, I'd like to follow up with what that criteria is.
I think it's set in 660, and I want to say that it was 18 and 2, but I need to double check that. 18 and 2, I believe, and before I start causing a wildfire here by saying that, I do need to check that because that's just off the top of my head. So.
And Representative Holby, immediately before becoming a state representative, I was one of those three members at the state level. One of the things that we have to keep in mind is the complicated formula for allocating seats to the board. There is a balance that has to be maintained between public and private sector, between business and labor, between all the different state agencies, and sometimes as much as we would like to start adding seats, the way the act is structured at the federal level, as you've pointed out, if you add one seat, you actually end up possibly having to add multiple seats with the other representation. It's a terribly complicated formula, I think unnecessary, and I am hopeful that the act may be up for review and perhaps some kind of modification at the federal level. Ron, I want to thank you very much. And we will look forward to receiving your report, and we intend to follow up on that, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee.
Appreciate your appearing today. For the rest of you, in light of some of the information that Mr. Murray's brought forward, our questioning went considerably longer than the chair had anticipated today, and I'm wondering, among all of you who we have requested to be here as witnesses today, if there are any of you, again, invited witnesses, who would find it difficult or impossible to come back on Thursday. If you have some kind of time constraints or scheduling constraints that would preclude that, I'm going to try and get you on here today. But the reality is that somebody's going to get dropped off of our witness schedule here today. Tim?
Chairman, with Dave Baker is our training director in Local 280, and unfortunately we have our yearly planning session on Thursday.
Yes.
For our JATC.
Okay.
So,
Tim, let's see if we can't get you up. Brian, you're in the building. Are you going to be able?
I unfortunately, Chair Witt, I do have a role as a public official in the city of Portland, and
okay.
I have duties to do that morning.
Okay. Pete, how about you?
I have some other meetings, I expect.
And who's our representative for the Contractors Association?
Contractors Association?
No, nobody here. Yes.
I'm Rod Belisle, listed on there, Local 48.
Okay.
If need be, I could possibly come back.
Thank you, Rod. I'm going to try and get all of you for the IBEW up together. With that, recognizing that you all have very busy schedules, and today needs to be the day, and I apologize to you. We invited you, and I'm going to do everything that I can possibly do to accommodate you. Can we collapse testimony so that we can get everybody on? Because it looks, folks, like it's either today or it's not going to happen, and I apologize for this, seriously.
You can do them together.
Okay. All right. Why don't we call up the IBEW next? Why don't we have you come up as a panel? Okay. Tim, were you going to come up? Or?
No.
Okay. If you have statements, give them to the committee assistant over there. Thank you very much. Gentlemen, my apologies in advance if we have to speed this up a little bit, but we had some information here that was a little surprising this morning, to say the least. For your own timing, I'm going to try and keep each panel to 15 minutes. So 7.5 minutes or so each, or roughly, plus or minus. If we could do that, I'm going to try and get everybody on here. Okay. Welcome and good morning. If you'd please identify yourselves for the record and proceed as you choose.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Rod Belisle. I'm the training director from the NECA IBEW Electrical Training Center in Portland, Oregon.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Baker. I'm the training director for Essential Electrical Training Center in Tangent, Oregon.
Good morning to both of you, and thank you. Mr. Baker, you've traveled a considerable distance. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Please proceed.
Well, I guess I'll just begin with a very brief overview of our program. Ours is similar to the UA's in a lot of aspects, so I won't go into great detail, but we have three different programs. We have a limited residential, which is a two-year program, limited energy, which is a three-year program, and then an inside electrician, which is a five-year program. Currently, we have about 500 apprentices in our program. We have, and some of the documents I provided have these numbers for you, we have approximately 11% female and 11% minority in our programs combined. I did some research in hearing of this meeting going back to 2000. That's when we started keeping records with our current database, and we've had since 2000 through 2008 roughly 10% minority, 10% female across the board for that 8-year span. We're privately funded. We're funded through our Contractors Association. Our apprentices attend school free of charge. We have them sign a scholarship loan agreement. Outside of that, we pay for their books. We pay for their tuition costs. They attend mostly during the day, and if there is a shortage in their hours, we pay for their lost health and welfare so they have medical coverage for themselves and their families. It's a great opportunity. You know, the wages start out $13.50 an hour. On average, between the three programs, they vary from $13 to $14, up to about $35 when they turn out. So they earn a living wage while they're attending apprenticeship. They get college credit so they can pursue a degree if they choose to do so upon completion of the program. I'm not sure what else I can provide you in brief detail. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, very good. And Rod, how long is your apprenticeship?
Our largest portion, the inside program, is 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And the apprentices go 20 days a year for 5 years, and then working the remainder of that schedule.
Okay. And I think that, maybe the concept that I had is wrong. Obviously, it's wrong, and I thought it was generally held premise that apprenticeships were 4 years. But you're the second person here this morning to describe a 5-year program. That's longer than the typical what we would anticipate being a 4-year college program. Can you explain? Has that increased recently, and why?
Yeah, the state minimum requirement is 8,000 hours on the mm-hmm. job training. It's difficult to get 2,000 hours a year. That's working full-time, never missing a day, never taking a holiday or vacation. And essentially, that's very difficult to mm-hmm. do in 4 years. That, joined with the fact we have a national curriculum, so we have a national parent organization which provides us curriculum in which we will then manipulate for our regional needs. We train all of our apprentices, for example, in solar. We provide every apprentice 24 to 30 hours of solar training. We do a lot of wind distribution type training, talking about inverters and variable drives, things that might be lightly approached in the apprenticeship program nationally, but in our region is imperative that we expand. We have a state license law, which is very difficult. A lot of states don't have that, so we have to provide additional training on top of the theoretical training that we provide, on top of the hands-on training. We have to provide code-related training to make sure that they're qualified to meet the state requirements for licensing. As the gentleman before me said, you have to complete an apprenticeship program, become an electrician in the state, or provide equivalent from some other state. So it's a difficult completion. We have a 86% completion rate within our program. That was mentioned earlier, that we monitor the number of apprentices we bring in so that we can verify that they can retain full employment while completing the program. We don't bring in more than we can use, so to speak.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rod, good to see you again. When I toured the facility on Airport Way, I was talking to Joe, and I said, well, how often do you have open meetings for people to come in and kind of view the system and see if they want to sign up and try to become a participant. And Joe was surprised that it was going to be July of this year. And I think I was there probably in September of last year, something like that. He was surprised that there wasn't going to be an orientation evening till July of this year. And so it seems like you've got plenty of applicants. Your pipeline is fairly full. How many new entrants into the program do you take on an annual basis? I guess is probably the...
Through the chair, Vice Representative Huffman. We bring in anywhere from, on a typical year, 80 to 120 new apprentices a year. We get approximately 1,000 applicants a year. So we bring in 10% of the people that apply. We do orientations on a monthly basis for people that are interested, and then we hold application periods typically in July and January, typically twice a year. And that provides us a pretty adequate pipeline for the number of applicants we need. We do additionally hold open applications for some minority groups and some pre-apprenticeship programs that are affiliated with our program. So there are some exceptions to that.
Thank you very much. Dave, welcome. Good morning.
Morning, Representative Witt.
A long trip.
It's not that far.
I get to work up here, so.
Okay. Well, thank you for making it and for appearing today, please.
Good morning. Well, some of the requirements we have for our training is much like Rod has for Portland. We are a national curriculum, so we follow the same guidelines that they put out for our programs. I provided a copy of a curriculum that we provide for all our training and all the programs that we have at our training center. We're a little bit different. We do have charges to students, $200 for tuition annually, and about $400 for books. But this does come with living wage, employer-paid health care, and equal pay. I'll point out that the minute you start, regardless of your gender or race, you're paid equally as your counterparts. And we look at training as far as being an apprentice is a career, is not a career position. It's a pathway to becoming a journeyman. So at length of the programs we have, 5-year, like Rod said, it's hard to keep them employed for that many hours over a 4-year period. So they would usually take about 4.5 years to get the 8,000 hours on the job. So we provide that extra year of training for code-related purposes. And I did provide a number of minorities and women that we have in our program right now. So we're actually recruiting any able body to come into our system.
All right. Very good. Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Your training facility, I believe I've been in the training facility you have in 2005, maybe. Is yours similar to what he has? It was kind of a classroom procedural where they had classrooms, they had different varieties of electrical challenges and learning processes. Is yours almost the same as this?
Through the chair, Representative Esquivel. We're a little bit smaller, 30,000 square feet. It was built in 2000. We've got 8 classrooms and 5 labs. Also, applied learning is what we look at. We have a curriculum that we follow, theory, and if we can put applied learning into the hands of the students, or journeymen, that's what we provide. So our labs are hands-on demonstrations. Then usually we have some mobile labs because we're a smaller facility that we can roll into a classroom as needed or into the auditorium, which is a larger facility for us. But we're roughly about the same.
Very good. Representative Dembrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to the question that I posed earlier about shorter-term training programs as opposed to your programs. We heard last week about the WIN technician program out at Columbia Gorge, which is having a great deal of success. Portland Community College, where I work, is starting a solar program. I think Lane Community College has a solar program. So can you talk about how your programs interface with those or are in contrast to those, or just, you know, what that relationship is, please?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Dembrough. Ours is career training, as was mentioned earlier, so we do have a bit more structure, I would suppose, for the long term. But
like any business, you know, we're supported by a contractor association, and if there's a need within the industry, we have to react to that need. Our electricians have been building those wind towers for the last 10 to 12 years that they've been assembling them up at the gorge. Typically, those have been assembled by local union members from our local or the surrounding locals. We try to react as something hits the surface. We try to start reacting. Our national office typically provides us curriculum before the industry is ready for it. We've often provided training on new technologies for energy efficiencies, for example, and it ended up that the product line or the concept never took place in the area. And so we did a lot of training that, unfortunately, we were never able to apply because the industry didn't accept it. We feel that we do react to those needs. Sometimes we feel that because it's called green energy, people think there's a new technology out there that we need to be aware of. Our apprentices are going through 5 years of training for that basic knowledge of a solar panel, for example. The attached wiring is the same as it would be for any other type of circuit.
To the chair, Representative Denbro. Also, we're the leaders in solar energy. The book that we've been using for the last couple of years through the National JATC, I've got two members that are working with Local 280 that actually helped write that book. So their names are in the book. Our national program has been the one that other models are looking at to use for training, and we do have some experience in that. And Rod's right. I have several members that have been working up in the wind tower facilities for many years, and they do have a national curriculum. Our national curriculum is rolling out a windmill boot camp to kind of address the upcoming technologies that are out there. And we have trained at our facility. I know Rod's trained a lot more, about over 400 apprentices and journeymen in the solar energy. It's a 40-hour class. They're ready to take the certification, NABCEP certification, entry level. And so we're working towards that. And all our apprentices in our program are now going to be going through enhanced solar training before they turn out.
And Mr. Chair, can I follow up? And so would you say that, you know, we talked with Mr. Murray about the pipeline for fitters. Would you say that the pipeline coming out of your programs is going to be adequate to deal with these new technologies, the demand in these, especially if there is stimulus money going into retrofitting and other kinds of green technologies?
Right. Through the chair, Representative Denbro. Yeah, I believe we do. We do lots of market surveys, and we look at things from a couple different perspectives. One is we don't want to flood the market and create unemployable people or people that have not completed the apprenticeship. That's a number one key is once we've made a commitment to an apprentice, we have to know that there's a career at the other end of that. And so we're cautious not to flood the market for the concern of the immediate need. On the other hand, we take market surveys. We continue to monitor the age of our membership so that we can replace that membership based on the number of hours we typically work in the industry in a year, how many will retire over the course of the next year. And we're looking typically 4 to 5 years out because that's essentially what it takes to create that journey. So.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Just to spin off of Representative Denbro's earlier question, isn't it a fair characterization to suggest that there's not necessarily a competition between, for example, the Columbia Gorge Community College Wind Technician Program and the program that you provide? There's room for both. Because, you know, theirs is electronic and computer lab designed, where yours is more electrician. So you, in fact, have guys working out in the field with graduates of their program because there are substations and switching yards and all kinds of stuff that they would not be qualified to handle. Isn't that a fair characterization?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Huffman. Yeah, that's fair. You know, we're sponsored by a contractor organization, and so if it's not the scope of work that our contractors would actively bid for a construction contract, we likely, at this time anyway, wouldn't be training in that area. So the wind technician, for example, we don't provide training in that arena because our contractors don't bid contracts to do that work. Should Bonneville Power or some organization contact us and request that we provide that for them, we would be glad to. We would be glad to take on that work as well. We would carve out a niche within our industry for a maintenance technician, as we've done with school districts, with other utilities. We do have maintenance contracts with other industries. It just hasn't been approached. But should it come up, the people that have built those pieces of equipment likely are pretty capable of maintaining them, certainly. Please.
Just to follow up, sir. And one thing I'm working on in the gorge is through the Dalles Area Chamber of Commerce, for example, and NECA member, Higher Electric, for example, trying to get them to the table with Vestas and Horizon and some of these others for the extended long-term maintenance, because the maintenance contracts are due to expire with the original warrantied work,
right,
from GE and whatnot, and making sure that local contractors are at the table to be able to bid on the long-term maintenance contracts for the switching and whatnot.
Right. Thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, real quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you also experiencing people that come into your programs that lack reading comprehension levels as well as math levels?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Esquivel, our selection process actually kind of weeds out people who might have trouble meeting the math requirement. What we ask is they have to provide documentation for the math requirement, which is usually a high school algebra and a completion degree of some sort, even a GED. So they have those skills. The next thing, if they actually fill out the application, get it in on time, they have to take an aptitude test, and that's been administered by the American Institute of Research through our national training program, that found a way to select people and ask them questions, because the biggest portion of our trade is to communicate. How we communicate from one to the other is whether the job gets done on time, right, and no one gets injured. And so they have to come through and take a math placement test along with a reading comprehension. And if they don't get a certain score, they don't move on to the next round of interviews. So we're making sure that we select the most qualified applicant.
Please. But let's back up a little bit here. When these people come through the door, do a lot of them lack math and reading comprehension skills? That's my question, actually. Not necessarily the ones that are in the program, mm-hmm, but the people that are coming in and applying.
Through the chair, Representative Esquivel, I think for the most part, people kind of understand what we're looking for, and so the ones that do come to us are usually have the skills.
And that would include the 1,000 applicants that you get.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in our case, we over the course of a year, we took applications twice. We got 1,100 applicants. Over 80% of them are qualified, meeting the minimums. There are a lot of people that come to a monthly orientation to ask questions about how they can improve their qualifications. So we know there's probably an equal number out there that didn't apply because they knew that they would be disqualified. We make that clear.
Thank you very much. I know that, Dave, I think it was you who mentioned that your program is actually being adopted by, your curriculum is being adopted in part by the national program. I just think that speaks to the quality and the level of education and training that the IBEW places here in Oregon. You folks also have a five-year program that is extremely demanding, and I just want to give you an opportunity to tell the public the kind of program that you present. I think you two, both of your locals, have received national recognition in terms of your apprenticeship training. A little opportunity here to tell us about that.
Mr. Chairman, our program, we have myself and one other instructor who sit on national code-making panels, and we actually write various chapters of the National Electric Code, which is the code that's enforced in the state of Oregon. My instructor is sitting on a solar panel, so he writes the codes for solar because Oregon is a leader in that. He also has worked with some of Dave's employees on the solar textbook that's recognized nationally. Our program in Portland has been recognized for many years as a leader. My predecessor sat on many boards with our national office and had large input on the direction of our national program, frankly. I'm the lucky recipient of all that work at this point. So,
well, tremendous. Dave?
Representative Witt, I may have misspoke. We didn't write the curriculum. Basically, the national curriculum was provided to us, and we had two people sit down and help rewrite and go over the changes that were in the book. So we have hands in actually how that became administered out throughout the nation. I also have several of our members that are on the code panel. We have two people that are on the code panel. I forgot which services I think they're in. And we have a national curriculum or national training institute we attend every year. These are instructors go back and attend training so that they're well-versed in how to provide the program to the apprentices and the journeymen. And I myself and Rod is also a product of our own trade. We came through the apprenticeship program.
Wonderful. And I think the level of training that your locals provide is the very basis for why you gave us the wage range of $13 to $45 an hour. And a gentleman, the very excellent level of training you provide makes it possible for your journeyman to be earning a very good family wage level here in this state. And thank you for all of your efforts in that regard. And thank you for coming today.
Thank you for your time.
Appreciate it very much.
Chair,
thank you.
Members of the committee.
Next, I'd like to call up Brian Craig, please. Pete, we're going to get you on, too.
Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be in front of you again at this session, kind of following up on a few things from last session on it. I will try to collapse what I'm going to bring up. I think Ron Murray and Rod, they brought up a number of the points that are very similar. Brian, for the record, Brian Krieg, I represent the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association and also the Sheet Metal Workers International Local 16. And I also do represent the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. As I said, many of our issues that are out there, we all, the three major trades of electrical, plumbing, and sheet metal HVAC have a lot of similarities and a lot of similar frustrations. And I've detected a little bit of a pattern of some of your questions, so I'm going to try to aim some of my comments to those to help. And I'm going to break it a little bit into three parts, a little bit of the current snapshot of where we're at in the economy, also the training needs that are there, and then the education system, which we got some very good stuff for you on. Currently, we have about 10% of our guys are out of work. It's not a huge number. I mean, there's always a small percentage that are going to be transitioning back and forth from the job standpoint. What we're looking at, though, down the line, 6 months to a year, is another scenario that looks a little bit bleak on the one hand. If you look at what the architects have going on in the books at the moment, there's not a lot of work going on. Actually, architects are losing their jobs. And what that does is about a year and a half down the line, that means there's not a lot out there, and that's on the commercial side. We also have an issue of we're seeing, you have to remember that the trades can move, and we are not a licensed trade, and so there's not quite the same barriers to entry as there is for plumbing and electrical, and so we're starting to see contractors out of the Seattle area starting to come down and underbid jobs down here and taking work away from our local guys. This is going to be probably a bigger issue over time, as it's, the economy is an issue that's much bigger than just Oregon, of course. We're looking forward, though, to some other things that are very good in the pipeline, the potentially out there, both state and federal stimulus packages. And there's a lot of discussion and a lot of energy out there about energy retrofits of buildings. better HVAC systems in them are a key component of that. It's one of the biggest areas where we're going to have the energy savings. There are environmental positives to changing out many of these systems. And we look at that literally any building that's somewhat over 10 years old in the state with its HVAC system that's over 10 years old, we've had technological leaps forward at this point that we can replace units and actually cover their costs in a very short amount of time on the energy savings on them. You're going to be confronted with quite a few different bills that are coming through different committees about this, and I think I'd really encourage you to look at the fact that that type of work will generate jobs, help keep this industry here. We have a very good trained workforce that can work on those projects, helps the environment, helps the energy issues. You've got a lot of things that can all come together. So we're very hopeful that actually there's some very good things coming down the line in the not-too-distant future that may soften the downside, that downslope that we're seeing. While you're analyzing those projects and putting them in place, I think one of the important things is to not be panicking about jobs out there and reducing the standards, though, for the contractors who work on them and the actual workers who do the work. I think we can reflect back to the Depression, and we look at the projects that were put in place during that time period and how well they've served us. We didn't dumb down standards during those time periods. We did quality work. And so that's something that we're a little bit concerned of. I'm very concerned about some comments that were made by the head of Oregon Economic Development Department, Representative Holvey and Representative Chair Witt. Heard those in front of the Sustainability Committee about needing to relax some contractor standards because of a lot of work that would be coming on water facilities in the state if all the stimulus package comes through. We don't think that we need to lower them down, and we do believe the workforce is in place to do the work on those. In the area of training, we have a facility out in Northeast Portland. Many of you have been to it, the HVAC and Metals Institute, about 50,000 square feet. We do have a satellite operation down the Eugene area. It's much smaller. In our case, because the domination of our industry is in the Portland area down to maybe about Salem, most of our training of certain types of activities do happen there at the training center in Northeast Portland. We bring the guys up. We have some kind of flexible schedules to be able to do that, though. And we take certain of the classes down south and then along with some of the basic classes. Apprenticeship, as with the other trades, has crept up to 5 years. A lot of it is the hour situation, but we're also having to teach a lot more things. And a little bit of that is remedial in nature. We have to start at an earlier point than we used to maybe in certain of the trainings, partly because we don't have shop classes anymore, so you don't have any kind of exposure to what you might be doing in the trades. There's also a lot more emphasis on safety. We spend a significant amount of their first year really is focused on safety training, but that continues throughout their career on it. But we also add in a few other things. They're fortunate in their third year of apprenticeship, I get to teach them a class on state and local government. And this year, I have to say, they were very charged up about it. And
that is the highlight of it.
I've had a few classes early years back where they, you know, turn out the lights and they all fell asleep. But I have to say, we have a new generation coming up that I'm hoping that in a few more years, maybe we'll see one or two of them populating chairs in this building on it. But training, our long-term horizon, it's stretched out a little bit more about that, the fact of the baby boomers disappearing and all. I think people are going to be working a little bit longer. I think we all are going to be working a little longer. But we are still going to have our training needs. Access to good applicants is probably the biggest problem, and you've been touching on that heavily. And we, like the other trades, do need to have the math classes. They need to be graduates from high school. What we're finding is they don't have the math skills. They don't have the reading skills coming in. The current age of our apprentices right at the moment is 28 and climbing. With the economic downturn, we have quite a few apprentices now that are late 30s and even into the 40s coming and joining the industry. Problem with that is in an industry that has a lot of physicality to it, we really need younger workers at a certain point in their career as they're learning and doing a certain amount of the work. Over time, they're the ones who then become the estimators, the foremen, and as they gain knowledge and at a point where they're not doing some of that same level of work. If we bring in apprentices late in their career, the physicality is very difficult for them in the long haul to get the hours and the amount of time in. But one of the other areas that I would say that we still continue to struggle with, we have a fairly good minority representation within the trade, but we would like to increase that. Problem is realistically, there's a lot of other people who want to get those same people we're looking for. It's the minorities who have graduated high school, who have the math skills, have the reading skills. They're in demand. The colleges are trying to recruit them. The military is trying to recruit them. And many other businesses are out there, too. I'd say that that's a very hot target for everyone at the moment. So trying to reach and make that diversification that we would like to see is actually very difficult on this, as long as we have an education system that is letting too many of them fall through the cracks. The issue, I think Representative Denbrough brought up about flexibility of training, I think it's one of the things that we actually have in our advantage, is that because, as Rod related about the needs of the contractors being able to be communicated very directly to the training center, we don't have a long curve of making some shifts in the types of things that we can do. As we see that we need extra skills or new skills are coming online, we're able to flex with them and get those classes in a very short amount of time. Our training staff, all of our lead instructors at the HVAC and Metals Institute are all actually have gone on to get their college degrees in training. We have international standards are created by our joint groups back in Washington, D.C. The International Training Institute provide us with a lot of up-to-date and very creative teaching materials now. Things like green energy is what it's related to. Well, it's just new technologies being applied to, you know, basic concepts on there. Yes, we have a lot more work now with controls and newer types of pieces of equipment, but we do train to that, and that continues to be something we are constantly improving on. The one of the things that is an issue for us is then getting onto the education issue. And Representative Esquivel, I was monitoring your hearing here on Thursday, and you said a very important thing about needing to bring back the dignity of trades and that type of work. And that has been, as I think Ron mentioned, it's been a struggle for us with many of the folks out there, is that this is good work. And it is not work that can be done by anybody. You do have to have good training. You have had to have an education, and you have to have some aptitudes in there. And it's an important part. It's not going to go away. We're always going to need plumbers, electricians. We're going to need people who can work on HVAC systems. If we didn't have them around, it'd be a little hard to work in this building. I think the new air conditioning system in here has been a vast improvement. I was in a very packed hearing yesterday, and we weren't sweating in our suits in it for a change, and that was great. That was a SMACNA contractor who did that work also. have to get a plug in.
Little advertising.
One of the frustrations we're having is looking at the education system. I talked about this. You had me back a couple of times last session. We talked about the fact we don't have the shop classes anymore. I'm sure everybody who sets up at this dais did some shop classes. You may have had some metal shop. You at least did some of those things. You had some exposure to it. Most of the schools don't have it anymore, and we're not exposing the kids to that. And one of the things within that is you know, some of you may remember back. I know that I struggled with math. I wasn't great in algebra and geometry. I was pretty good in it all, but the applied math that I got out in shop classes that I took really helped me understand what I was trying to learn, and it made it a little easier to go back and struggle through the book and the rest of the classes on it. And we had a lot of those shop class teachers were also math teachers, and they have a technique and a way of working with people that might be a little different. And we have to remember that not everybody learns in the same way, and that is something we've really gotten away from. And by not having those folks, this is part of our issue about why are our apprentices coming in at 28? What did they do for 10 years of their life maybe in there, where we could have gotten them in for a good job, good wage, get their pension going, get their health care going, so they're not a burden on the system? It's critical that we start to look at this again. We had one bill last session. Representative Witt and Representative Dallum were working on it. A couple of you may remember where we were trying to look at getting some opportunities to bus kids in from some of the more outlying rural areas to get an exposure so they could at least see the training centers we had and learn a little bit. Our training centers, many of them in the Portland area, are all involved in some programs, have been for many years, where we're actually teaching teachers, math teachers, science teachers, about applied learning, and that they take back out into the school. That bill didn't make it through for a number of reasons. We've also participated over the years in these workforce councils and other types of activities. Felt very frustrated. It's very time-consuming out there. We just weren't seeing change, and didn't feel we were being listened to. So sometimes you have to go out, grab the bull by the horns, and say we're gonna break the models out here. We're going to do something different. And what we came up with the help of a number of other trades and the Oregon Building Congress was, let's look for a partner and create a new charter high school, something that's a hybrid, where we work together with a school district to bring the shop classes and some of that teaching in, share the students back and forth. Well, we started that, the concept kind of ran it up the flag at first, rebuffed a little bit from one entity, but the school districts of Park Rose, Reynolds, Centennial, Gresham, Barlow heard what we were up to, came to us and said, we want to be your partner on that. And what was created out of that is a new school. It's called the ACE Academy. It stands for Architecture, Construction, and Engineering. And it's an opportunity for the kids to go to this school part of the time, sharing the FTEs, and not just sharing a little percentage of it, but really sharing the FTEs on a very equitable basis, where a couple of days a week, those kids are coming out from their schools and are getting applied math, applied science types of classes, but learning about construction. And what that means is that could be in construction, engineering, and architecture. One day they may be working on looking at how surveys are done in the surveying industry. They could be out in the wood shop. They could be coming over to learn about HVAC and metals. This facility, we have a facility, and the carpenters are gracious enough to loan a bunch of room in their new facility and build out classrooms there. That's still underway. We have, I think, currently 142 students from these schools, juniors and seniors. They come in. Some of the days they're there learning at the Carpenter Center. Some days they're at the HVAC and Metal Institute. Some days they're at Local 48 and at the Northwest College of Construction. We also get them out on the construction sites. I've seen these kids. I've seen the energy and enthusiasm of very different teaching methods going on, and they're very excited. The school districts are very excited about this and partnering with us. What I think was maybe the most excited group on it are the teachers that we hired, and how excited they are to be able to teach without certain of the shackles on them that they have had in the system that they've had to work in. The principal from the school is the former director for the Park Rose District, and we've selected a very good staff. And one of the things I have for you is a copy of Building Futures magazine. It's the cover article, and I flagged two articles about it. I really encourage you to take a moment when you have a chance to read about this, because it's innovative, it's different, and what we're hoping, these kids are being exposed to a lot of different career opportunities. Some of them are going to go to college and be architects and engineers, we hope. Some of them may end up in the building trades. And if nothing else, even if they don't end up in those, we think that they're going to be very successful young people with a much better perspective on how the world can work.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I just want to thank you for coming forward and talking about the trades and your programs. Well, one of the things you mentioned, I'll go back earlier in your testimony, you were speaking about the pipeline, which is something we're concerned about in this committee, and certainly addressing the quality of applicants, you know, and their experiences as they come up through the education system is extremely important in this ACE Academy. It looks like a really good model. But notwithstanding that, I noticed I had some numbers done earlier 4 or 5 months ago by the Employment Department cooperating with Boley on our pipeline, essentially an apprenticeship. And I noticed some differences between the licensed trades and the unlicensed trades in the projections of workers going into the future. And certainly we're in a downturn in our economy right now where we don't really see that demand out in front of us. But, you know, looking out, you know, when we see the potential stimulus package coming and the economy turns around, I expect that we're going to have a huge rush on people, you know, needing to be in the trades to build out this infrastructure that hopefully this nation will be investing in. And so looking beyond a year, these numbers look to 2016 and across just the building construction trades, taking into consideration what we're graduating now and everything else, we're short some 14,000 construction workers in the trades. And albeit the electricians and the plumbers don't really have those large numbers that they're going to be short, and I've been... The only difference I really see is in their programs, they have license programs that require apprenticeship to get a license. And maybe that, I don't know if that's the reason they don't have the projected shortages, but certainly it is alarming for the rest of the trades, I think, to look at that and not, I guess, get... complacent because our economy is slow right now, because I believe when our economy does turn around and we have a lot of infrastructure coming at us, we're going to be really hurting for people in the trades. And just wondering your comment on that.
The crystal ball on the needs in for the long haul and how many people we're going to have out there is challenging to project. The general feel I get from the contractors is that we can probably, our workforce is not so old within our industry that we're looking at a huge drop-off very quickly at about the same time some of the ramp-up is going on. We've had a lot of innovations in our manufacturing and the systems that we put in now that have reduced a little bit of the manpower need, and we probably foresee a little bit of continuation in that direction, so that helps alleviate some of that also. As we're gearing up to take care of that in the trades, as long as we have applicant pool that has enough of the basic skills on it, the training centers themselves, we run them at differing hours of the day, but by no means are we, you know, at a 24/7 type of scenario out at the training centers. We could have a lot more staggered classes and employees coming back and forth a little bit, along with we have our journeymen, of course, we have our apprentices. We also have another category of worker called classified workers, who are allowed to do a fair amount, and we actually do a fair amount of training with them. It can be viewed as a pre-apprentice program. We also have a lot of classified workers that we utilize that don't go on into the apprenticeship program because for one reason or another they're satisfied with what they're getting and the wages that they're getting. So that provides us a fair amount of flexibility within the workforce. I think it does go back to, in the long run, that the pool that we can reach out to and the exposure issue and trying to find the people so that they have an idea that there's these types of jobs out there. And that, I think, is one of our most critical things. Is who knows what an HVAC and a sheet metal worker does in this day and age. So hopefully I answered your question.
Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, Brian, I have the solution to your problem. IBEW and NECA has 900 people a year that have applied. They're looking for work, and they're looking for a place to go. So you guys just need to stand there at the door and say, we have a home for you. And
Actually, it's interesting. The trades actually have some joint nights, and a lot of people do apply actually maybe for multiple training programs, and there is some a little bit of back and forth on that, and I think we'll probably see even more of it. But it does go back to that main threshold of those 900 coming in. A vast amount of them just don't have the qualifications. And then so the question is do we need to go and retrain them? And as Mr. Murray was saying, okay, we're starting to do our own classes to do some of that. And that is actually one of the things that in watching the proceedings on Thursday here is really kind of gets my dander up a little bit, is the community college is talking about we're going to have remedial math and remedial reading classes. Once the horse is out the barn, if they can't graduate high school and be able to read and have the basic math skills out there, we really need to be working at keeping them in and providing them other ways of learning. And this is part of the issue of shop classes are a different way of teaching math, and we need to be able to start moving them over to that. And so it's the quality of the worker, isn't the volume on that. We have lots who would like to. We do get applications for, and we kind of have to sort through. We'll go the extra steps if we have to do the extra training. And I think that there could be probably in the long run a lot more synchronicity between the community colleges and the trade schools that the unions have and some of the others out there. And as you had noted about, okay, there's a little difference of the guys putting the towers up and installing versus then the long term of what is needed to be actually running the facilities out there and really having more discussions about that and not duplicating programs. And I think that going back to, you know, your training issues also from last session, you had a lot of people, a lot of companies, a lot of organizations coming here telling you they had training needs, you need to put money to it, you need to do all these things. Well, why haven't they been doing it all the way along themselves? We've built that factor in. And that's part of why, yes, the union rates are a little higher, but that's because we put money back into the system. We use it, you know, it's kind of a user fee. I mean, those who are using our services are paying for the training that happens for it. And that's why our wages are there. And I think that we need to be looking at all contractors really need to be putting in to the training in one way or another of that level and so that the state can focus on other types of activities that we really need. And it may be that like more of the remedial type of work may need to be done.
Brian, thank you very, very much. I'm going to have to cut this short, but before we let you go, I just want to say that I think you're onto something here with your ACE Academy. This is an incredible concept, and the fact that you've got so many players involved in helping to make this a success, maybe breaking that mold is a pretty good thing.
We're very excited about it, Chair Witt, and I would offer that the folks who are there at the Academy have told me that they would be more than happy to come down here and be available for testimony at any point during the session if you would like to know more about that.
Fantastic. I think that would be an intriguing possibility. Just a very, very interesting concept.
Or if you would like, you could come and join us and see the facility as an offsite.
Representative Esquivel just passed me a note to that effect. So thank you very much for that offer. We're going to see what we can do about that. Thank you very much, Brian. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Pete Savage from the Carpenters Union. And we're going to run over a little bit here. And committee members, I understand that if some of you need to go, that you may be called elsewhere because we do have floor session here. With that, Pete, welcome. Thank you so much, and welcome to our committee.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Chairman Witt, members of the committee. Thank you for having me down here and making time to let me testify a little bit today. Talk a little bit about where we're at right now and what our program sees going on. So currently we have 885 apprentices in our program. 19.5% of that are people of color. 6% of those are females. The average age is up to 31. So we are having a problem recruiting from the younger workers, have been having that problem since we'd like to tie it to with the demise of the shop classes in the schools, as you've heard, is when we started seeing our number creep up. We just don't see young people that have had hands-on and piqued their interest in building things.
Pete, if I could interrupt just for a minute here.
Sure.
For the public record, would you please identify yourself and your organization?
My name is Pete Savage. I'm regional manager for the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. We are affiliated with the United Brotherhood of Carpenters.
Thank you.
We have approximately 5,000 members here in Oregon. 70% of my membership is over 35. Currently, we have about 250 retirements a year. I would say with the current economic situation unfolding, we could expect that number to climb as maybe a worker that's 51, 52 may have planned on working 5 more years. If he sees himself being unemployed for 4 months out of the year, that retirement check looks like a pretty even trade-off. This year out of our apprenticeship program, we'll graduate 117 journeymen. 8.5% of those will be female. The average age has crept up to 35 of those sticking with the program coming out. We have a new training center we purchased in the Portland area out by the other ones off of the Airport Way about 4 years ago. We've invested about $10 million in that facility. It's an 80,000 square foot facility with about 40,000 square feet of classroom space, another 40,000 of lab space. We are hosting the ACE Academy, and we're expanding right now so that they can expand. We're very proud to be partners with the ACE Academy. We're hoping that we're going to be able to draw some very interested young people out of there in the near future. We spend about $2.5 million to $3 million a year of members' money on training. This is money that's deducted from their check every hour they work to help ensure the future of our workforce. It also pays for any advancements in training that they want. When green jobs are spoke about, I get kind of confused because what's a green job? To me, it's a carpenter's job. It's a millwright's job. It could be an electrician's job, a pipe fitter's job. It's just a different application of some new processes to learn. We currently have gotten a grant and are rolling out a LEEDS training program for our members. We'll have it up and running by June or July. It's really, I think that we're blessed in this area that we have the largest green developers, LEEDS certified buildings of any state in the country. And so our members have done most of that work, and so they're already have a hands-on knowledge of it. What they don't have is the knowledge of what makes it the LEEDS. They know that they put a blue skin on the building and it seals out this and that, but they don't know why and the different applications of what makes it what. So we're putting that training in place. We look forward to embracing it going forward and all the part of that that will be in the stimulus packages that is being talked about. We hear about the there was discussions about how we interface with the community colleges and what's the difference between taking a one-year course at the community college for carpentry as opposed to taking a four-year apprenticeship. I think the difference is that when jobs get pigeonholed, if I was to take somebody and train them to be a maintenance technician for windmills instead of using a millwright for maintenance or an electrician for maintenance of the windmills, when that industry slows down, or if we over-train for that, or whatever happens, they don't have the ability and the other skills to just trade off and maybe go into a paper mill and work, or a solar chip plant and work. I think that by getting a more broad-based education, we're training somebody who will be able to add to the economy in our state for much longer, and we won't find ourselves 5 years down the road having to retrain them and watch as their family suffers and they go through that unemployment crisis that many of them do. We have gotten to where we are in our diversity numbers by partnering with about 5 different pre-apprenticeship programs. So we work with Oregon Tradeswomen. We work with the ETAP program that came out of the Housing Authority of Portland. That training is done at our training center. We were one of the first sponsors of that. We also work with Portland Youth Builders, Irvington Covenant Development, and Job Corps. A couple of those have direct entry into our program. We feel their standards are high enough that if you complete their program, you are definitely eligible to be straight into our program. Many of the others we don't at this time, but they are working towards that. Some of the outreach efforts we use, we can bemoan the situation in the schools with the lack of shop classes, but what we've found is we just have to get creative about how getting into the schools. So instead of sending letters, what we've done is just sent people out and knocked on the doors, talked to the counselors. What we've done is I've sent math instructors from our training center in and done sessions at Roosevelt High School. We've done sessions at Madison High School, Franklin High School, just to try and give the students an applied math learning that they weren't getting. We'd take a small project and show them how to use the math to make all the cuts out of one piece of wood and get the project together. Seems to have been a big success. It started getting a lot of requests for more of it. Became more than we could afford to sponsor as a nonprofit organization. We also have a summer school program that we instituted in the Portland area with our partners, the contractors of the GCCA and AGC. We take 20 students from inner city schools. They're paid $10 an hour for 8 weeks. They get 2 days a week classroom time at our training center. Actually, 1 day a week. We changed that, excuse me. And now, and 4 days a week on the job. The contractor pays them the whole time. So even when they're in school, so they can make some decent money over the summer. We provide them with boots and safety equipment. Out of that, we have gleaned over 2 years, three apprentices, and one student that's gone on to study engineering at OSU. So we just feel that you have to kind of just change how you've been going at things. Business as usual is how that we've done through the 60s and 70s just doesn't work anymore. We have to find more creative ways of recruiting. Trying to condense this down and respect your time here. I think what's lacking, you already heard about the lack of shop classes. I won't go over that again. I think when people talk about the disrespect of the trades, that may be part of it, maybe just more of where they come from. Most of your counselors in the high schools that went through college, that's the path they know that was successful for them. I think they truly wish their students to be successful, but that's the only path they know and the one that worked for them. If you look at the statistics, that 60% of the people starting as freshmen in high school aren't going to go on to secondary education. Of those that go on, 60% won't graduate. So where does that leave us? You know, where is this workforce? How are they being trained up? I myself am a product of a technical education through Benson Polytechnic High School in Portland. My father went to Benson. My uncles went to Benson. I think you'll find that Roosevelt, Franklin, Madison, all those kind of schools way back, you know, they all turned out people who could step into some trade. And the people who are older than us, that's how they made their living. That's where they picked up their training. That's how they supported their families. And we've kind of just gone away from all that. So we need to get back to it. I think the commitment from the contractors on training has really slacked. In the last 4 or 5 years, we've made a real concerted effort with our contractors to try and meet the apprenticeship standards within our contracts for how many percentage to have on the jobs. They're doing a lot better, but I think that a lot of contractors get comfortable with a worker, even if they started them as an apprentice, that they want to just keep their steady workforce they have and they know. An apprentice is a bit of a risk, especially when they're brand new. They are a higher injury risk. And the mistake ratio, I mean, they're going to make a couple. So staying on that, I think what we can do things different, the ACE Academy is a great example. We can work on trying to get some shop classes back. I don't know how fiscally feasible that's going to be for you as you look at your budgets going forward. I think what could do is more partnerships with the training centers. We also have a training center in Tangent. We have a training center in Redmond. They're both new. I think that if schools in the area partnered and used those facilities when they could, we'd be happy to open them up and share. I think we could get some training going on and get some young people coming out that had an interest. And I think the other thing we can do is make sure that owners, especially the public, when we build projects for ourselves, we need to have standards on there for apprenticeship. We need to make sure these people are getting trained. You know, like I said, we have 885 apprentices in our program right now. Of that, 220 are out of work. The biggest risk to their education is not continuing employment. So whenever we build something, we need to try to make a spot for them to continue their education. Because once you get to that journeyman status, that's what we are. We're journeymen. We travel for work when it slows down. So if it slows down here and they're building cold fire plants in Wyoming, I'll see you in a few months when I'm done building that. And that's we've got to get those people to that part so they can keep supporting their family, because there is only so much work in the area. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Pete, thank you so very, very much. Questions or comments from the committee? Pete, I just you mentioned the summer school and your involvement, and while I have not seen particular training school, I was a guest at the summer school graduation in Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C., and you mentioned that you train inner-city youth. Mm-hmm. I have never in my life seen such an excited group of kids. It was over the top. They loved their training. A number of these kids were getting up in Washington, D.C. at 5 a.m. to get a bus, to go to the metro, to get a bus on the other end of the subway to get to the training program. These kids have never been up at 5 a.m. ever before in their lives. And, I mean, they simply were not missing these classes. Their excitement, the excitement of their families who never thought that they would see their kids graduate from anything. The pride was just overwhelming that day, and I've got to tell you that this is the greatest program I think I've ever seen. So keep up the very good work. You're saving a segment of society there and giving them an opportunity for a middle class lifestyle that just wasn't there if you guys didn't step up to the plate. It is a tremendous program. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to reiterate something that Mr. Savage spoke to and went over very quickly. When I mentioned that I had some numbers run out by the Employment Department on the need for trades and the skilled workers, I would recognize that the carpenters long term probably have the largest need in sheer numbers, because they are the largest trade in the list is that I'm seeing, and they also have other pieces of the trade. He mentioned millwrights. They have pile drivers and drywall and acoustical ceiling and a few others. But you know, I think he touched on something about our contractors and having a culture where we have a commitment to those apprentices to make sure they get through the program. They make the journeyman status, because when they get laid off, we've just invested 2 or 3 years in training and they disappear out of the system. If they were journeymen, they could go someplace else, they'd have that trade they could rely on and secure another job. But when they drop out as an apprentice, they oftentimes disappear for good. And it's that commitment that we need to ensure we have job opportunities on our projects for apprentices. And I know many of the trades don't see eye to eye on this particular issue with me, and we have been having many conversations about this particular issue, but I think it's a really important one that we need to wrestle with. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holby.
Chairman Witt, Representative Holby, if I may, just for a moment. You know, one effort that's gone on to that I think could be used as a shining example, in the South Waterfront area of Portland, where there's been a lot of development go on, OHSU, North McAdam Investors, there was an agreement made for 18% apprenticeship, 20% people of color, and 15% women. I sit on that South Waterfront Oversight Committee, and I can tell you that to date, 24.8% of the hours worked on that project have been worked by apprentices. Of that, about 600 different apprentices from different trades have journeyed out while they worked on that project. The diversity numbers are stellar. I believe it's at about 22% people of color and about 8% for women. So it can be done with a commitment of owners and users, and I think it's the future for us.
Thank you very much. Committee members, with that, I'm going to have to gavel this meeting closed. We're on the floor in 2 minutes. Thank you all very, very much. The plumbers, sheet metal, electrical, and carpenters have world-class apprenticeships, and we're very fortunate to have it here in Oregon. With that, we are adjourned until Thursday.